All right, welcome everybody. It is Thursday, August the 9th. We've had what ended up being a two-week break rather than a one-week break in our discussion of microeconomics. I hope this extended schedule has not, the change in the schedule has not inconvenienced anyone too badly. As was explained in the email, we're going to keep the content of the course the same. We still have three remaining lectures starting with tonight. We're just going to end a week later than we originally planned. We've already talked about the basics of the market, the basics of economic goods, exchange, and the prices of goods and services in exchange markets. Today we extend the analysis forward into a more advanced topic, but also backwards in the sense of Menger's notion of the different orders of goods. So in the, our examples from the last lecture of pricing of bottles of water, and I can't remember what other goods and services we used in our example, we were talking about the pricing of final goods, consumer goods. Today we want to talk about the pricing of factors of production, those goods and services that are used to produce other goods and services that eventually are consumed by the end consumer. So in other words, what we're going to be talking about today is production, the Austrian theory of production, and if we have time, a little bit about the Austrian theory of the business firm, meaning the boundaries of the firm and the organization of the firm and so on. You know, I'm having a little bit of fun with my dear President Obama as we talk about entrepreneurs and how they build firms, firms being production centers. I want to make a special note to those of you who attended Mises University this year, either in person or on video. I gave a lecture at Mises University with the same title as this one, Production and the Firm, but I want to assure you that what I'm going to do tonight is not a rehash of that Mises U lecture. Rather, this is a somewhat more advanced treatment of some of the similar of some similar topics, building on the analysis that we've already covered here in the Mises Academy course. So first, some definitions. Right, what's production? What's a firm? Right, well, here's a good definition of production that comes from Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. The use by man of available elements of his environment as indirect means or cooperating factors to arrive eventually at a consumer's good that he can use directly to arrive at his end. And apologies to those of you who don't like male, the use of the male pronoun. Of course, Rothbard's writing back in the 60s. The more we would do it in a more politically correct way today. But notice in the definition, right, that this is, that, you know, production is the idea of transforming, you know, things that are available in the environment and using them in ways that satisfy the wants and needs of the end user, the consumer. Right, so if the consumer is, you know, if you're on a desert island and it's sort of a wonderful place where bananas and coconuts just sort of fall from the trees and you don't need any tools to open them or to prepare them, you just pop them right into your mouth, fish jump into your mouth, and I guess you don't have to cook them. It's sushi-grade fish, so you just, the fish just jumps into your mouth, you eat it, and you're satisfied. But then all you do is consume. You just consume what's around you, and everything you need to satisfy your ends is immediately available. Of course, that isn't the case in most situations, right? Even most guys stranded on a desert island, at least from what I know from the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, you need some tools, right? He had to, as I remember from the movie, it took him a while to figure out how to open the coconuts using a rock, or some other kind of a tool to pry them open. Towards the end, near just before he escaped the island, right, he was spearing fish with a long spear that he had carved out of a piece of wood. Even to provide medical care on the island, he had to use a tool. If you remember, he had to knock out his sore tooth with a rock and a really gruesome scene from the movie. Anyway, I hope I'm not spoiling it for those of you who haven't seen it. But even on a desert island, you have to transform the things that are available to you to get them into a form where you can consume them, right? So the idea is that production is not creating something out of nothing. It's not just, you know, waving a magic wand like in Harry Potter or something and causing food and clothing to come into existence. Rather, it's taking the stuff that's already in the environment and transforming it with your labor to make it into something that you could use. Notice also that Rothbard's definition emphasizes purposeful human action. Right? Production is not instantaneous. It's not automatic. It requires some planning, some foresight, some knowledge, some execution on the part of the human actor. Right? This is important because some theories of production in neoclassical economics act as if production, you know, once it gets started, is a kind of automatic process, right? It's like a plant that's growing in a pot. And once you plant the seed and you add the fertilizer and the water or whatever, then the plant just grows on its own, right? Frank Knight, an economist I very much admire in other contexts, had what in my view is a very faulty theory of production, in which capital is treated as this sort of, you know, pool of funds that perpetually generates consumer goods. The capital is, you know, like think of like a some kind of an automated factory. You push the start button, and consumer goods just come out of the end of the production line automatically. Right? The Austrians have always emphasized the human element, right? In particular, the vital role of the entrepreneur. Notice also that Rothbard's definition implies the passage of time, right? So production isn't instantaneous. It takes some time, and it involves, there are distinctions among different kinds of goods. Remember, think back to Menger's notion of higher order and lower order goods. There are higher order goods that are transformed into lower order goods, and there are different types of higher order goods. Right, some of them are labor, natural resources that are sort of already available, right? And some of them are capital goods, tools, machines, buildings that are themselves produced by the originary factors before they are used to produce consumer goods. One of the things I like about Rothbard's book, Man, Economy, and State, which of course we didn't assign as the primary text for this course because it's a 1,000-page book, but it's certainly something that you should have on your reference shelf. Of course, you can download the whole thing as PDF, for free. So maybe you have a virtual reference shelf, but as a book that you can use to look things up. Rothbard, somewhat surprisingly, devotes a huge chunk of Man, Economy, and State to production theory. And you know, a lot of people get into Austrian economics because they're into the free market, and they're into libertarianism or anarchism or whatever, and they think, well, I'm going to, you know, Austrian economics provides me all the tools that I need to defend the free market, and I'll just read a little bit about, you know, basic economics, and then the rest will be all about smashing the state and criticizing regulation and attacking the Federal Reserve. Well, I mean, you could do all those things with the use of Austrian economics, but the body of theory is actually quite a bit more involved than that. And in this lengthy 1,000-page treatise, Rothbard devotes a huge chunk, I mean a quarter, almost a third of the book, to the mundane aspects of production theory, which we've been talking about, which we'll be talking about today, and we've already hinted at in earlier lectures. So this is a really, really important part of the Austrian school. So what do we mean by a firm? Right? Well, a firm in this sense, you can think of it as the locus of productive activity. It's where in an advanced industrial economy, production processes are organized and governed and supervised. Right? So firms are directed by entrepreneurs, human agents who engage in action, right? And the firm takes resources, factors of production, and transforms them into either later stage factors of production to be used by other firms or consumer goods to be sold directly to consumers or sold to wholesalers who will then retail them to the consumers and so on. Okay. So let's talk about factors. And we're going to spend a lot of our time tonight on factor pricing. It's an extremely important application of Austrian production theory, but it flows very nicely and naturally from the discussions that we had last time, the whole notion of the marginal pairs and how prices are determined by bargaining among people who want a good and people who have a good. Now, the basic principles of factor pricing from an Austrian perspective are as follows. The rental prices of factor services that are rented and the purchase prices of factors that you can buy and sell are determined by demand and supply in factor markets. Totally simple, right? Just as there are markets for water, right, and markets for ice cream and markets for massage services or whatever, likewise, there are markets for machines and markets for factories and markets for land and markets for labor, right? So prices of intermediate goods are set in markets just the way the prices of final goods are set in markets. That much is, you know, obvious and easy and straightforward. However, there are differences, key differences, in between factor market pricing and the pricing of consumer goods and services. Right. First, notice I stated, I said rental prices, I distinguished between rental prices and purchase prices. That's because some factors of production cannot be bought outright, but can only be borrowed. The most obvious example being labor, right? So labor is an input into production, right? Labor is a factor of production, but unless we're talking about a slave society where you could buy and sell human beings, right? Outside of that, you can't buy and sell people, you just borrow their labor services, right? An employer hires an employee and says, Mr. Employee, I will pay you X dollars per hour in exchange for you providing the following services for me. So when I pay you a wage, that's essentially the price of renting your labor for a specified period of time. Maybe it's specified per hour, per week, per month, per year, whatever. Right? Just like you can rent a building, you can rent a house, you can rent a car. Right, you might pay so many dollars per day or so many dollars per week for the services of the car from Hertz or Avis or Europe Car or whatever. You don't own the car, right? You're not buying the car outright. You're simply paying for the right to use the car in specified ways, and you're paying so many dollars or euro or whatever per unit of time. Now, many factors in labor markets are exchanged on a rental basis. Sometimes land and buildings, sometimes machines, and almost all the time labor. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about, spend a lot of time talking about the rental prices of factors of production. Now, sometimes you can buy the factor outright. I mean, you can buy a car as well as renting it. You can buy a machine, you can buy a factory, and you can buy land. And we'll talk a little bit about the relationship between rental prices and purchase prices once we get there a little bit later in the lecture. The other thing that is a little bit different about factor markets as compared to markets for consumer goods is, you know, kind of the underlying demand, right? The demand for factors is a little bit different from the demand for consumer goods, right? Here's a bottle of water. I have my trusty bottle of water in front of me for giving tonight's lecture. And I'm willing to pay so many dollars, you know, to own or to rent or whatever this bottle of water, right? Why? Because I'm thirsty and I want to consume the water to quench my thirst. Ah, delicious. Okay, so I just, you know, satisfied an end on my value scale, the end of having my thirst quenched. And I used this water bottle as a means to that end. What about hiring a worker? I mean, that's a little bit different, right? So suppose I decided that, you know, I'm Peter Klein. I'm too much of a big shot to give these lectures. I'm going to hire an underling I'm going to hire a minion, a flunky, a disciple, and have him give these lectures on my behalf. Let's say his name is Murphy. Say his name is Bob Murphy, just for that, just for an example. So I hire Bob Murphy as my minion, right? And I say, look, Murphy, I'll pay you, and he's not worth very much, I'll pay you $5 an hour if you'll give my lectures for me. Now, if I'm a commercial provider of lectures, or I'm working through the Mises Academy and getting paid, right? So let's say I'm an entrepreneur and I have a business giving lectures. Why would I hire Murphy to give some lectures for me? I mean, what benefit do I get from having Murphy sitting in the chair next to me or in the office next to me giving lectures? Right? It's not because I get any direct utility from having Bob Murphy around. Heaven forbid, right? It's not that I get a warm, fuzzy feeling in my heart every time Murphy walks into the room. No, if I'm an entrepreneur, the reason I would pay money to have Murphy around is because Murphy will provide some goods and services that I can sell for money. Right? If Bob Murphy produces stuff that I can sell for $10 an hour, and it only cost me $5 to hire him, right? Or if he can deliver, three lectures during the course of the day, and I can sell those lectures for $50 a piece, then I can get $150 from selling the stuff that Murphy produces. So I would be willing to pay something, right, to have Murphy around because he can generate $150 worth of revenue for me. It's not that I directly consume Murphy's presence in my building. It's that I use him to produce stuff that I can sell to consumers who give me money. I just want the money, okay? So when we talk about the demand for water, right, we can go directly from my preference ordering, right, the utility that I get from consuming water, to my willingness to pay for units of water. And remember, we talked about the law of diminishing marginal utility. So I'm willing to pay less for the second unit than the first, and less for the third unit than the second, and so on. And we can go directly to the demand curve for water, and we can use that to explain the price of water. It's a little bit more indirect in the case of a factor, right? Because in Murphy's case, right, the demander of Murphy's labor is me, the entrepreneur. But we cannot go directly from my value scale to my willingness to pay for Murphy. My willingness to pay for Murphy, and hence the shape of the demand curve, right, how much I'm willing to pay for a certain amount of Murphy, right, that is derived from the consumer's willingness to pay for the stuff that Murphy produces. We sometimes use the term derived demand to describe the demand schedule for a factor of production, because the demand by entrepreneurs for a factor of production is derived from the demand of consumers for the final good or service that that factor of production produces. Okay? So we're going to need to go through some intermediate steps, and that's exactly what we're going to do. The Austrians have a very specific and a historically important explanation for the demand for factor production. And it goes under the word imputation. Imputation. This word was coined, or at least the German equivalent was coined by Friedrich Wieser, as a way of explaining the process by which valuations get imputed up the chain of production. Right, if we think of Menger's notion of higher order and lower order goods, consumer valuations for the lower order goods are imputed backwards or up the production process until they place value on the higher order goods that are used to produce those consumer goods. Now, let me just state the Austrian theory of imputation as I have it here on the slide, and then I'll explain it. Right? So the theory goes as follows. The rental prices of non-specific isolable factors used in variable proportions. Okay, that's a mouthful, right? But for now, forget it. Just forget about that. Just say the rental prices of factors, right, tend to equal their discounted marginal revenue products. The rental prices of factors, certain kinds of factors, tend to equal their discounted marginal revenue products. Now, in just a moment, I'm going to define discounted marginal revenue product, and I will also define the terms nonspecific, isolable, and variable proportion. But all I'm saying is that the rental prices of most factors, there are a few exceptions, but most factors tend to be equal to something called the discounted marginal revenue product, or DMRP. Okay? The rental prices of other factors, right, factors that are not nonspecific, isolable, and used in variable proportions, are set by bargaining between resource owners and entrepreneurs. Okay? Now let me explain what all that means. What are marginal products? What are marginal revenue products? What are discounted marginal revenue products? This often goes under the heading, or these topics, often go under the heading of what's called the law of returns. The law of returns states the following. Holding constant the quantities of complementary factors, there always exists an optimum amount of a variable factor. Excuse me. Holding constant the quantities of complementary factors, there always exists an optimum amount of a variable factor. Now, what do I mean by a variable factor? Well, that's any factor of production that can be used in variable amounts, right? You know, take the example of growing a plant in a pot. Okay, so I have some flowers in a pot. What are the factors of production that go into the production of these beautiful flowers? Well, I need a pot. Right, I need some dirt, I need seeds, I need water, I need sunlight, fertilizer, maybe insecticide, who knows, other kinds of things depending on what kind of a plant it is. Right? So take water, for example. I don't know if any of you are experienced gardeners, right? But if you have a if you have a plant and you don't water it at all, it's going to die. You have to water the plant to keep it alive, right? But you can also add too much water, right? So if you add a little bit of water, the plant grows, a little bit more water, the plant grows a little bit more, but it's possible to drown the plant or kill the plant if you put too much water in the plant. Right now, what we mean by complementary factors is the other things besides water, right? Dirt and the pot and the seeds and the fertilizer and so on, right? So, the law of return says, look, suppose that I have a plant and it's, it grows to be 5 inches tall with a little bit of water. If I water it a bit more, it'll grow to 6 inches tall. If I add a little bit more water, it'll grow to 7 inches tall and so forth. Right now, it can't be the case that I can simply keep adding more water without changing anything else, right? I've got to have a bigger pot. I've got to have more dirt, I've got to have more fertilizer, more insecticide, and so on, if I always want a proportional increase in the amount of the pot. Right? I mean, I can have another pot next to it, and then I get twice as much, I've got two flowers instead of one. But I can't simply add one variable factor and get more and more and more and more and more of the thing that I'm producing. Right? There's always some limit to how much additional growth I can get, how much additional output I can get, by adding just more of one factor without adding more of the other factors too, right? Because if you're producing a good or service with multiple factors of production, there are typically some complementarities among them. You've got to have so much of each factor used in certain proportions. Now, maybe those proportions aren't completely fixed, right? A little bit more fertilizer will give you a little bit more plant. A little bit more sunlight will give you a faster growing plant. So there's some variation in how much output you get when you change an input, leaving all the other inputs the same, but within strict limits, right? That's all the law of return says, that there's some optimum amount of a variable factor, where if we use any more of that variable factor, you don't get any more output. Now, some definitions. The marginal physical product of a factor is the addition to total product from adding an additional unit of the factor holding other factors fixed. Okay, so how much more product or output you get when you add one more unit of a particular factor holding everything else fixed, right? So if I add a teaspoon more water, I get a teeny bit more plant. That would be the marginal physical product of that teaspoon of water. Okay? Now, the concept of diminishing marginal returns states that as units of a factor are increased, its marginal product eventually falls. Okay, so there comes some point at which when I add one more unit of the factor, one more teaspoon of water, or one more squirt of fertilizer, or one more minute of sunlight, right, the amount of extra plant I get starts to get smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually it's zero or maybe even becomes negative. Right? If that weren't the case, if marginal returns were constant or increasing, you know, then I could grow the entire world's food supply in one pot. Right? I'd have a stalk of wheat and I'd just keep adding water and nothing else, and I'd get more and more and more and more and more, you know, wheat. And then I could feed the world with just that one little pot. Right? That isn't the case, because at some point you've got to add more pot and more soil and more seed and so forth. That's because of diminishing marginal returns. When you just add more of one factor without also increasing the complementary factors, you don't get the same amount of bang for the buck. Okay, another definition. Marginal revenue product, right? That's the marginal physical product of a factor, the marginal product of a factor, times the price of the final good. So notice that marginal physical product, or marginal product for short, that's expressed in physical unit terms, right? How much more plant, how much more wheat, how many more lectures Bob Murphy can give, okay? So the marginal product of an hour of Bob Murphy's labor is how many additional lectures he can deliver, right? The marginal revenue product is that additional stuff times its selling price. Okay, so if each lecture is $50, then if Bob Murphy has a marginal product of one, so when he adds one more unit of his labor, he can deliver one more lecture, and I can sell it for $50, then the marginal revenue product of that hour of Murphy's labor is $50. Right, so MRP is expressed in dollar terms, in money terms. Whereas MPP, marginal physical product, is expressed in physical unit terms, bushels of wheat, inches of plant, hours of lecture, or whatever. Okay. Now, from the entrepreneur's point of view, the entrepreneur is interested not only in the marginal revenue product, but also in the discounted marginal revenue product, because, remember, production takes what? Time. Production takes time. I don't instantly get the revenues from the sale of the output at the moment when I purchase the inputs. Okay, so I hire Murphy and I say, okay, buddy, here's your money. Now go do these lectures. But then it takes him a while to prepare the lectures and to deliver the lectures and to work on his jokes and his karaoke singing and all the other things that Murphy does. And so I don't actually get the money from the students or the listeners until after I've paid for Murphy's services. Right? Now, that's the case in most production processes. That's not a praxeological law, right? But, you know, depending on how the structure of payments and receipts is, depending on how payments and receipts are structured, how the schedule is structured, if I have to pay for the factor up front, then I'm not going to pay quite as much as what that factor is worth at the end of production, because I have to account for the passage of time, right? So I would discount the marginal revenue product, not the interest rate, to decide how much that revenue, that additional revenue, is worth to me now, okay? Why do we care about all this? First, let me give you some examples of MRP, or marginal revenue product, and then show you some pictures and some diagrams to explain how it helps us to explain factor pricing. Okay. Kendrick, did I grab a typo on my last slide? I'm sorry. That should be DMRP. I don't know where I got DBRP. Sorry about that. That's just a typo. So the last bullet on slide 4, that should be DMRP. discounted marginal revenue product. I have no idea where I got DVRP, but I'm sure it's Bob Murphy's fault. Okay, so how is MRP calculated? Here's just some numerical examples, right? So imagine you have a case where the factors can all be used in variable proportions, meaning, you know, it's like growing that stalk of wheat in a pot. You know, it's like, okay, you need soil, you need water, you need fertilizer, you need seed, you need sunlight. But I mean, you know, they don't have to be all in exactly the same proportion, right? You can vary the amount of, you know, you can have a bigger pot or a smaller pot and you can still grow the plant. More water, less water, more fertilizer, less fertilizer. You know, it's not like you get no wheat at all unless you have exactly the right proportions, okay? So imagine that we have a production process that's like that. And imagine there are three inputs, just call them A, B, and C, okay? So we have, imagine that, you know, you can combine 4 units of A, 10 units of B, and 2 units of C, and get output that you can sell for $100, okay? But then imagine that you took away 1 unit of A. This is just like Menger's notion, right, of how you value a good or service on the margin, right? Imagine if you lost 1 unit, what would be the loss in value? It's exactly the same principle here, right? But now we're talking about on the production side. So what if I lost one of my units of A? Right? If I, suppose that 3A, 10B, and 2C only produce $80 worth of stuff, right? Stuff that I can sell on the market for $80. Well, then the marginal revenue product of A is $20. Why is that important? Because look, if forgetting about discounting for a moment, if I had 3A, 10B, and 2C that could produce $80 worth of stuff, and somebody came along to me and said, hey, Clyde, would you like an additional unit of A? I'll sell you a 4th unit of A. How much would that unit of A be worth to me? Well, remember, I don't value it because of the direct utility I get from consuming it. I value it because I can use it to make money. How much money? Well, if I had one more unit of A and got up to 4, 10, and 2 instead of 3, 10, and 2, I could produce $100 worth of stuff, stuff that I could sell for $100. So I would increase my revenues by $20 if I had that one more unit of A. You see where I'm going with this? How much would I be willing to pay for that unit of A? Well, if I could get it for $1, would I do it? Heck yeah, because then for $1, I would get something that allows me to produce $20 more revenue. I'd add to my profit $19, right? What if I had to pay 10 for it? I'd still do it. 15, I'd still do it. 19, well, if somebody offered me a unit of A for $19, then I wouldn't be as happy about it as when I could get it for $1, or if I get it for $10. But yeah, if I paid $19 for that marginal unit of A in my first example here, I would add $19 to my costs, but I would add $20 to my revenues, so I'd get an extra dollar profit. I'd do that, okay? So notice that, again, forgetting about discounting, the marginal revenue product of the factor establishes the entrepreneur's maximum willingness to pay for a unit of that factor, okay? The entrepreneur would not pay more than the MRP for a unit of that factor in that range, right? So I've already got 3A, 10B, and 2C. I wouldn't pay 21 for another unit of A. I wouldn't pay 50 for another unit of A because then I'd lose money, right? But I'd pay up to $20, but not a penny more, right, for another unit of A. Now, you know, there's some other examples too. Suppose that you have the case of fixed proportions, right? So fixed proportions is where there's no variability whatsoever. You got to have exactly this amount of A, exactly this amount of B, exactly this amount of C. It's like, you know, the textbooks give silly examples like left shoes and right shoes, right? So if I have one left shoe and one right shoe, and you offer me another right shoe without its partner, without the left, then it's not very valuable to me. Shoes are only valuable to the consumer in pairs, right? So this is the same kind of thing on the production side. Imagine that it's very precise. You know, instead of growing wheat in a, you know, in a little flower pot, now I'm, you know, manufacturing semiconductors in a clean room, you know, in the Intel factory or something like that. It's not like you have a semiconductor and, you know, well, let's just add a little more silicon and we'll get a little bit better semiconductor. No, I mean, you've got to have all of the little components have to be precisely, exactly, you know, in the right proportions. So imagine that, you know, same thing, 4A, 10B, and 2C allow me to produce $100 worth of stuff. But, you know, if I only have 3A, you know, if I only have 75% the amount of A that I had before, then I'm only going to want 75% of the other factors too, because the extra parts won't be useful to me. They'll be like a right shoe without a left. So if I only have 3 units of A, then I would only use 7.5 B and 1.5 C. Suppose that produces output that's worth $75. Well, then the marginal revenue product of a unit of A is, in that case, $25. Notice it's higher than the $20, right? And that is what we would expect in general, right? That if factors of production have to be used in exact proportions, then each one is more valuable on the margin than if they can be used in variable proportions. Okay? Because you got to have each one. Each one is necessary in certain amounts to be able to get the output that you want. Now, Rothbard uses the term isolable and non-isolable in this context. I don't know if that word is even in the dictionary, but isolable just means you can isolate it. So non-isolable means you can't isolate it, right? So what Rothbard means in this context is that a factor is isolable if the entrepreneur can evaluate its contribution to output independent of the contributions of the other factors, right? In other words, I can hold everything else fixed. I can add a little bit more of just this one factor and see what happens to output and to revenues, and then place a value on just that specific unit of the factor. If factors are used in fixed proportions, then you can really only place a valuation on the bundle, right? Not on each individual element of the bundle on its own. Just, you know, with a pair of shoes. You can place a value on the pair of shoes, but you don't really have an independent value of the left shoe and the right shoe because you need them to work as a bundle, right? And it's sort of an extreme case. Right? Imagine that you have factors that are highly specific to a particular production process. They're not isolable, and they're indispensable. In other words, suppose that if you don't have A, if you don't have a unit of A, then B and C are worthless. Okay, so maybe in the case of the plant, A is the seed. Right? You can have all the dirt and all the fertilizer and all the water and all the sunlight you want, but if you don't have a seed, you're not going to get any plant at all, right? So imagine that, you know, one unit of A, 2 units of B, 3 units of C allow me to produce output that's worth $200. If I took away that unit of A, if I lost it, I still have my 2B and my 3C, but then it's nothing. I have no wheat, okay? So my output is worth zero. This is sort of a weird case because, look, if we just work through the math, right? What's the marginal revenue product of A? I mean, how much revenue do I lose if I lose one unit of A? Well, I lose the whole thing, the $200. Okay, so the marginal revenue product of the isolable factor is equal to the value of the whole bundle. Now, I mean, there's nothing wrong about this. It's just sort of it's an unusual case where you have a marginal revenue product that's equal to the price of the whole thing. Now, some critics of the Austrian theory of imputation, like George Riesman, for example, author of Capitalism, have argued that this somehow invalidates, Austrian theory of imputation. But I think, you know, he says, for example, that if you have a car that's worth $20,000, if you lose the steering wheel, then the car is not worth anything, right? But it doesn't cost $20,000 for a steering wheel. Therefore, marginal productivity theory cannot explain factor prices. I think the proper response to that is to say, look, all that marginal productivity theory tells us, at least so far, is what is the maximum that an entrepreneur would be willing to pay for a unit of a factor? And if the factor is indispensable, then the maximum you'd be willing to pay is the value of the whole thing. Right? I mean, again, to see that, imagine there's some, I don't know, some zombie movie. You know, the zombies are taking over and they're coming towards you, and the only way to get away is to drive away. And there's only one car left or something, and you want to drive away from the zombies in that car, and there's no steering wheel, and some guy comes up to you and he's got the only steering wheel and he's trying to sell it to you. You know, how much would you pay for that steering wheel? Well, as much as you would pay for the whole car. Right? Whatever is the value to you of having that car, and maybe it's, you know, all the money you own to get away from the zombies, you'd pay that much. If you already got the car, you'd pay that much for the steering wheel, because without the steering wheel, the car is useless. Right? But now, under normal circumstances, the prices of steering wheels are not in the market equal to the price of the final good for other reasons, right? Because there are multiple suppliers of steering wheels competing for the entrepreneur's services, and the materials that are used to make steering wheels are not urgently needed to make other things in the economy. So steering wheel manufacturers can get the inputs at a pretty low price, and competing against each other, the prices of the steering wheel end up being much less than the prices of the car. This by no means does this mean, as Riesman argues, that costs, you know, that prices are determined by cost of production. No, no, it's just that prices are determined by the value of goods and services in other uses in the economy. And in the case of the steering wheel or any indispensable factor, the actual price on the market is typically much lower than the maximum that a user would be willing to pay if there were only one unit of that factor left and you just had to have it. Okay? We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. You know, look, we could do this using our charts and tables and graphs that we used last time. Right, so imagine the simplest case. Imagine we have an isolable factor, meaning a factor the value of which can be isolated from that of other factors. You know, a teaspoon of water that's used to go into a growing wheat, or an hour of Bob Murphy's labor or whatever. How's the price set? Well, you have entrepreneurs, the users of factors, who demand units of factors based on the discounted marginal revenue product, right? So imagine that, you know, there's an entrepreneur, a group of entrepreneurs who are interested in acquiring this unit of the factor, right? Let's say that the first unit of the factor has a DMRP of $30. The second unit of the factor, because of diminishing returns, right, is not worth quite as much as the first unit. It's only worth $27. And the third is worth $25, and so on. Right? So this is the demand schedule for units of this particular factor. And again, it's just like the demand schedules that we looked at the last time, except that the demanders are not consumers whose willingness to pay is determined by subjective utility, but rather entrepreneurs whose willingness to pay is based on how much they think, how much money they think they can make from using those units of the factor, right? But you also have factor owners, right? I mean, and just, for example, suppose that there are five units of the factor. There are five teaspoons of water out there, or five steering wheels or whatever, and each owner of the factor, for whatever reason, has a reservation demand, right? So these factors have reservation demands for factors of production, and let's assume that they vary. Right, so one person would be willing to give up his factor for as little as $9. Another person would be willing to give up his factor for $11, and so on. And we can do our analysis just like we did before using the marginal payers. Right? Notice, by the way, in this case, that the reservation prices of the factor owners are all lower than the willingness to pay for the fifth unit, the last unit of the factor. That's going to make things pretty simple. Right? If we do this on a graph, right, the entrepreneur's willingness to pay for the first unit is $30, and for the second unit is $27, and so on. Right, imagine that there only exist five units of this factor. The stock of the factor is five. Imagine that these reservation demands, right, even the stingiest current possessor of a unit of this factor would be willing to let it go for $17. And all five of the units have a DMRP of more than $17. Then we know that the equilibrium price, that the equilibrium outcome is going to be that all five of them are sold. Right, so all five units of the factor are sold from the factor owners to the demander or the demanders. And if we use the principles of pricing that we established last week, right, if all five are sold at the same time in a market with a uniform price, right, then the equilibrium price is going to be $20. Okay, that's where the demand curve intersects the stock. Right, so all five units will be sold, and the equilibrium price will be $20. Somebody's just emailed me and is saying in the chat, why would it be between 17 and 20? Remember, I mean, the 05, he won't sell it. I'm sorry, he would sell it for anything greater than 17, right? But the buyer will not pay more than 20 for the last unit, right? The equilibrium price can't be 17.50 because DMRP of the fifth unit is $20. So the entrepreneur would not pay, would not be willing to pay more than $20 for the particular unit of that factor. Okay. Let me sort of generalize the deal by imputation here. The Austrians developed this theory of imputation in response, right, to the sort of, you know, the British classical view, the view of Adam Smith and Ricardo, the view that Riesman embraces, right, that the prices of goods and services on the market are determined by their cost of production. Right, what was unique about the Austrian idea of imputation is to flip this on its head, right, and say that no, the Austrian view is that costs are determined, that costs are determined by prices, meaning the costs of factors of production the cost that the entrepreneur pays, you know, how much money does it cost me to, how much do I have to pay for Bob Murphy's labor, right? That's part of my cost as an entrepreneur. The costs of factors are determined by the prices of the goods and services that those factors are used for. In other words, it's consumer valuations that are imputed backwards to factors of production rather the other way around, right? In other words, all costs, right, are essentially opportunity costs. Right, the cost of Bob Murphy's labor is in the economy determined by the value of Bob Murphy's labor in something other than, you know, working for me. Right, factor prices tend to equal their DMRPs, as we just saw. This leads in a market to factors being allocated to their highest value uses in production, and for resources that can be bought outright, you know, like a machine or land, the purchase price of these resources, the purchase price of a capital asset, is equal to sort of the present discounted value of the expected future stream of marginal revenue products. Right? So in other words, if I think that Murphy is, well, that's a bad example, but if a piece of land is going to generate, you know, $100 a week for the foreseeable future, right, then I want to take that expected future stream of marginal revenue products and discount it all back to now to get a lump sum amount. Those of you who have done, you know, if you've calculated these sorts of things, this is your standard finance problem, right, to how to calculate the present discounted value of a stream of future payments. It's like calculating the value of an annuity, for example. You know, some of the common fallacies, right, this helps us to understand some common fallacies. Like, for example, look at my beautiful picture here. This is a picture of the Champagne or Champagne, right, region of France. This is where they grow the grapes that are used to make expensive, fancy champagne. Now, if you wanted to buy some of this land in the Champagne region, to to put up a little chateau or to become a winemaker or, you know, for a shopping mall or whatever, that land is really, really expensive, right? It's extremely expensive land. And Mises uses this example, right? In the classical view, the view of Smith, Ricardo, and so on, would be that, well, the reason champagne is so expensive when you go to buy it at the store, right? A nice bottle of champagne easily be over $100, $500, super high-end champagne, you could pay $1,000 for a bottle. But the reason that champagne is so expensive, according to the classical view, is because, you know, to make real champagne, not sparkling wine, which is what you're supposed to call it if the grapes come from California, but real champagne is made with grapes that are grown here, right? To be real champagne, the grapes have to be grown in the Champagne region of France. So to do that, you have to have access to those grapes. You have to buy them from the people who produce the grapes, and they have to buy this really expensive land to grow their grapes. So of course, the champagne maker is going to have to pay a lot for this land, right? So because the land is so expensive, it's very costly to produce champagne. Therefore, the consumer has to pay a high price, right? It's like the producer takes this cost of production and adds them up. He puts a little markup on the top, and then he passes all that on to the consumer. The Austrians pointed out that no, the reality is exactly the other way around. The causal mechanism goes precisely the other way around. In other words, the reason this land is so expensive is because people really like to drink fancy champagne. People are willing to pay $100 or $500 or whatever for a bottle of fancy champagne. Therefore, the grapes command a very high price in the grape market, and therefore the land commands a very high price in the land market. Right? Champagne entrepreneurs are competing against each other to get that land because they know they can use it to make stuff they can sell at really high prices. Right? And it's easy to see this, right? Imagine that you know, there's some new religious movement, let's say, and you know, the whole world stops drinking alcohol. You know, there's some sort of teetotaler movement around the world. Imagine the demand for alcohol completely, you know, falls radically or even drops to zero. Nobody's willing to pay anything whatsoever for champagne grapes. What's going to happen to the value of that land? Right, I mean, it's still nice land. It's pretty. It can be used maybe for growing other things. It's a nice place to put a little, you know, a little vacation home. But it's not going to be anywhere near the price that it is now. Right? The price of the factor is determined by consumers' value for the output, not the other way around. Okay. Now, I'm going to flip through a few application slides pretty quickly because it's, you know, it's fairly straightforward stuff. Excuse me. You know, what explains changes in factor prices? Well, just as we have, just as we would explain changes in the prices of water by reference to supply and demand, we can do the same thing for changes in factors, right? You can have a change in supply in the stock of a factor, or you can have changes in the demand for a factor. And I'll just quickly show you, you know, two different cases, two different reasons why you might have a change in demand for a factor. Either it might be because there's a change in time preferences in the economy, leading to a change in the interest rate used for discounting, or there could be a change in the productivity of the factor. Right? So just imagine we have a simple supply and demand diagram just like we did before. So on the vertical axis is the price of the factor. On the horizontal axis is the quantity of the factor. Remember, we're talking about factors here, not consumer goods, right? So these are units of labor, or these are acres, you know, hectares of land, or you know, rental surfaces of machines, or whatever. Okay, you know, if there's an increase in the stock, a bunch more land becomes available for the growing of champagne. Bob Murphy clones himself, and now there are two Bob Murphys. Oh my gosh. Then, you know, we can just represent that with a rightward shift of the supply curve, and the equilibrium price of the factor would fall from P1 to P2. Okay? How about changes in demand? Well, look, again, we have market for a factor. Let's say that the marginal revenue product of the factor is given by this line, and then, of course, the entrepreneur's willingness to pay is given by discounting that marginal revenue product based on the rate of interest. Right, so imagine that, you know, the original DMRP schedule is the one that I have indicated here, and the equilibrium price of the factor is P1, so many dollars per hour, so many euro per year, or whatever. And then suppose the interest rate goes up. Right, so even with the same physical productivity of this factor, Murphy still produces just as many lectures as before, the land yields just as much champagne as before, and it takes just as much time to do it, to produce it, as before. If the interest rate goes up, right, then the amount the entrepreneur is willing to pay up front is going to be lower than it otherwise would. Right, so the DMRP schedule would shift down and to the left, right, with an increase in the interest rate. So the factor price would fall from P1 to P2. Right, so at higher interest rates, the prices of factors of production, the wages of labor, the rental prices for machines, rental prices for land, and so on, and the purchase prices of those capital assets will go down. Okay. What if there's a change in, in the marginal physical product? In other words, Murphy, becomes much better educated and articulate, and now he can produce many more lectures per hour than he could before. Again, without any change in the interest rate, if Murphy's labor is now more productive than it was before, or if the land can now produce more grapes than it could before, that would be reflected by an upward shift in both the MRP and the DMRP schedules. Right? So we go from the, you know, this original DMRP schedule and a price of P1 to a higher DMRP schedule and a price of P2. Okay? So if a unit of a factor becomes more physically productive, you can produce more stuff with it, well, then its price on the factor market is going to go up. Another case that I didn't diagram that you can think about is, what if the physical productivity stays the same, but there's a change in consumers' demand for the output, right? So if the interest rate stays the same, the physical productivity of that land in Champagne stays the same, but consumers have an increased demand for champagne, the beverage, right? What's that going to do? Exactly, that's going to increase the marginal revenue product of the land and lead to a higher price on that land, right? Not because the land can produce any more grapes than it did before, but because the grapes are now more valuable to consumers than they were before, because consumers now like champagne even better. Okay? I have some remarks that are specific to labor. Maybe I'll just mention a few of them briefly, so we can have plenty of time for Q&A. Labor is very interesting and important as a factor. I mean, on the one hand, the principles governing the pricing of labor services are exactly the same as the principles governing the prices of any factor of production. Yet at the same time, because labor is human beings, right, it does have some idiosyncrasies, and of course it's a market that people really care about. People get very upset when wages in an economy are low, because then people are poor, blah, 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 blah. Nobody cares that much if the rental price of a industrial machine goes down. I mean, we would explain that using the supply and demand for the factor. We'd use the same supply and demand diagrams to explain those two cases, but, of course, we care about it more when it involves labor, because that's people and our friends and our neighbors and human well-being and so forth. A couple of remarks on demand and supply, right? I mean, again, the demand for labor is determined by, let me say it this way. The demand for labor on the part of entrepreneurs, right, they're the ones demanding labor, is determined by the demand of consumers for the stuff that that labor is used to produce. So, most of the time when we see changes in wages, it's most often empirically, historically, due to changes in consumer preferences for the goods and services that that labor produces. Right, that's much more likely to be the case than changes in productivity of labor or changes in the interest rate. The reason that you know, if you look at professional sports, for example, you know, the reason that the quarterback for you Americans out there, the quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, Drew Brees, just a few weeks ago signed the richest contract in NFL history. I think it was it 10 years for $10 million? I'm sorry, 10 years for $100 million? It might have been 5 years for $100 million, maybe $20 million a year. I don't know if anybody remembers, but it was gigantic. That's way more than the star quarterback of 5 years ago or 10 years ago was making. Peyton Manning in his prime, or Steve Young in his prime, or Joe Montana for you old-timers. Right? It isn't that Drew Brees, can throw that much better than previous great all-star quarterbacks. It's that NFL ticket prices and television rights and merchandising prices have all gone way, way up in value, right? So consumers are willing to pay a lot more for things related to football, to buy tickets, to watch it on TV, buying the products that are advertised on TV, buying the jerseys and so on, that the value of a star quarterback's labor is simply much higher in dollar terms than it was before. So, people, of course, a lot of people don't like this. They go, it's terrible that, this guy gets paid $20 million a year to throw a football, but, a social worker or, a doctor in sub-Saharan Africa or a school teacher or whatever, somebody who's contributing way more to the overall benefit of mankind, a professor, economics professor would be a better example, but they get paid much less and that's unfair and we don't like that, blah, blah, blah. I mean, of course, we're not dealing specifically with normative issues in this course, but, as a positive matter, right, the reason that doctor treating patients in sub-Saharan Africa earns a lower wage than Drew Brees has nothing to do with the moral worth of either party or society's value in the, intrinsic philosopher's sense of value. No, it just means that, the patients that doctor treats don't have any money, right? They have a low ability to pay or maybe a low willingness to pay, or whoever's paying his wage, if it's some NGO or the Gates Foundation or whatever, whoever is paying the services of that, the labor services of that doctor, they have a lower willingness to pay than people's willingness to pay to watch a quarterback, okay? That is not to say that there have not been increases in productivity of labor over time. I mean, I'm talking about changes in the value of quarterbacks over a short period of time, but over a longer time frame, right, in most occupations, the reason that, that farmers have a higher marginal revenue product today than farmers 100 years ago is because of the machinery. Right, 100 years ago, all farmers had was a hoe and a pick and a horse, right, and a horse-drawn plow. Now they have fancy equipment. They have, expensive combine harvesters with GPS and computerized fertilizer spraying, and all that kind of stuff. Right, so, over the long, sweep of history, the main reason why wages have gone up is because of the amount of capital that we have. Right, the amount of capital per worker has gone up. Has very little to do with unions or government regulation that protects labor and all this kind of stuff. Mises talks about this in several of his works. It's an economic fallacy that labor unions can raise wages for labor as a whole. They can sometimes raise wages for their own members. Okay, but the reason that we are richer, that wages are higher today than in our grandfathers' and great-grandfathers' day and so on, is because of improvements in capital investment. A few remarks about labor supply, right? Another thing that's different between, a machine and a worker is that, machines don't, they don't choose what occupation they want to be in. They don't decide how hard they're willing to work, unless it's like HAL in 2001. But workers do. Right, so for example, workers have different tastes for different kinds of occupations. A lot of occupations include the benefit to the worker of engaging in that occupation is not just the amount of money they get paid, but also there may be some intrinsic benefit or harm for that matter. Right, like me, for example. I mean, the reason I became an economics professor, you know, it's not for the money and the sports cars and the girls and the fame. I mean, you get all that, of course, but it's really just because of my intrinsic love for economics and my love for teaching students such as yourselves. A lot of people, you know, accept a lower wage than they otherwise would if they really like what they do. Right. So I mean. I wouldn't quit my current job to become a plumber, unless they paid me, I don't know, $1 million a year. For $1 million a year, I would clean out toilets. I would unclog toilets. I might even do it for $500,000 a year, right? But it doesn't, you know, I'm willing to be a professor for slightly less than $500,000 a year because I like doing it, okay? So workers may change their willingness to work based on preferences, and they might be willing to accept less money for what economists call a compensating differential. Right, a compensating differential is the extra money that you would have to be paid to take on a job that you really don't like. Okay. Again, for example, here's a market where imagine that the reservation demand for workers is below the current equilibrium price. So, you know, we have old equilibrium of 5 workers being hired for $20 an hour, 5 units of labor being hired for $20 each. But if workers decide they don't like this job anymore, right, or the worker in question says, I just don't enjoy this, I'm not willing to do this anymore unless I get paid even more. So the worker might increase his or her reservation demand to the ones that I have in purple, right? So at this higher reservation demand, now the equilibrium quantity is no longer 5. Right now it's only 4. Why? Because the fourth unit of labor is worth $22. The fifth unit of labor is only worth $20 to the entrepreneur. Right, the marginal revenue product of the fifth unit is 20. The entrepreneur will not pay more than $20 for the fifth unit of labor, but the worker will not supply a fifth unit of labor for anything less than this, you know, around 24 or whatever it is. Okay, so now that fifth unit of labor is not transacted. Only 4 units of labor are transacted. So again, this is increasing the reservation demand, leads to a higher price and a lower quantity. Okay. We can also talk about a lot of this explains why empirically why wages are high in some occupations and low in others. Right? If it's a job that lots of people love and lots of people are willing to do, their reservation demands would be low, such that you would get equilibrium wages that are pretty low. If it's something that nobody is willing to do, only a few people are willing to do, or only a few people are able to do, then you find equilibrium wages that are much higher. And then, of course, you know, the government can place barriers on entry into the labor market, which reduces the supply of labor and increases the price, you know, just like occupational licensing rules. I think I have an example here from lawyers, right? So imagine, in most countries, the lawyers' unions, the bar associations, have set up these complicated rules whereby you have to pass the bar exam and you have to be licensed by the state to be able to practice law in that country. Well, that has the effect of reducing the supply of lawyers, right? If you make them pass a complicated bar exam and only 50% can pass, right, then the supply of lawyers on the market is going to be lower instead of the original S. Now it's this lower supply curve in purple, and that's going to increase average wages, right? So one thing that unions have been very good at doing is making it harder for new people to get into the business, right? Unions always push for higher licensing requirements and other barriers to entry that make it difficult for new workers to enter the labor supply. Simple reason that increases the wages of workers who are in the labor supply. If you ever propose, as some crazy free market economists have done, that we ought not to have licensing rules for lawyers, that, you know, anybody who wants to help you write a contract or defend you in court should be free to try to do so. And if you're willing to pay that person, more power to you. Of course, the strongest opponents of any kind of scheme like that will be, that's right, lawyers, right? Existing lawyers do not want to make it easier for new people to become lawyers. And I think that's just really, really horrible. You know, in all industries except for higher education, of course, where the government should not allow anyone to teach who doesn't have a PhD and multiple publications and lots of work experience. Okay. Oh, wow, it's already 6:41. So I'll skip this slide and go on to talk a little bit about sort of some implications of the discussion that we've had. But what I think is important is that, you know, in Austrian production theory, there's no distinction between production and distribution. Some economists talk about, well, there's, you know, there's production. That's factors being used to produce stuff. And then there's distribution of income. You know, how much of the revenue that comes in from the consumers gets handed out to each factor of production. How much does labor get? How much does capital get? How much do entrepreneurs get or whatever? Notice that in the correct understanding, production and distribution happen at the same time. I mean, incomes are distributed as factors are purchased and employed in production. Production and distribution are the same process. But in other words, this is people who say that, well, you know, it's unfair that labor only gets, you know, 20% of the pie of all the money that comes into businesses. You know, that's not a fair distribution. Well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense in this case. Labor gets what it bargains for in the labor market, just as capital gets what it bargains for in the capital market and so forth. And this all takes place as goods and services are produced. Just a note about entrepreneurship, right? Let me skip this part because I think I can explain it a little bit better on another slide. Look at slide 20 here. You know, Mises has this concept of what he calls the evenly rotating economy, and that's a hypothetical condition in which there's no uncertainty. Right? So entrepreneurs know exactly what the future values of goods and services are going to be, right? So it's like, you know, in the absence of uncertainty, let's say I know that if I hire one unit of Bob Murphy's labor, that will produce, you know, $50 worth of lectures, the lectures that I can sell for $50 on the market. And so if we forget about discounting for a moment, you know, I'd be willing to pay up to $50 for that marginal unit of Bob Murphy's labor. And if there are lots of entrepreneurs competing against each other for Bob, then the equilibrium price of that unit of his labor would be $50. But remember, in reality, there's uncertainty, right? So in my business of selling educational services, I don't really know how much money I can make from Bob. Right? I don't know how good he's going to be. I don't know how many lectures he'll actually be able to produce and what quality they are. I really don't know how much consumers will be willing to pay for Bob's lectures. Right? So I mean, I estimate. Right? So if I believe that I can get $50 worth of revenue, of additional revenue, from hiring one more unit of his labor, then I'd be willing to pay up to $50, but no more. Right? Suppose you know, other entrepreneurs are not as clever as me. They're not as far-sighted as me. You know, they don't believe that Bob is really worth 50. They think he's only worth 30, and their maximum willingness to pay is 30. Well, I say I think Bob's worth 50, and so I offer 40 for his services, and maybe I offer the highest of anybody competing for Bob, and so I get him for 40. Right now, if in fact I'm right, if my forecast is accurate, that I can sell Bob, Bob produces lectures, I sell the lectures for 50, and I only paid 40 for his services, well, then I made a profit of 10 on that unit of labor, right? But what if I'm wrong? What if, in fact, Bob produces output, and the best, all I can get from selling that marginal output is, you know, $30, yet I paid 40 for it? Well, then I earned a loss, right? So you see that profit and loss are only possible if there is uncertainty about how much factors of production are really worth. Right, so in our previous examples where we said, well, suppose the DMRP is $20 or $25 or $30. Well, in the real world of uncertainty, entrepreneurs don't know what the DMRP is. They have to estimate it. They guess. They conjecture. They use their intuitive understanding to try to anticipate what the DMRP, you know, really is. And if they get it right, they can make money. If they get it wrong, they lose money. Right, so profits and losses cannot exist in this fictional, you know, equilibrium state of the ERE. Now, in the ERE, factors get their DMRPs. Right, Bob gets his $50, exactly what he's worth. Capitalists get interest for foregoing present consumption, but there are no profits and losses. You only get profits and losses in an economy in which there is uncertainty. Okay. I have a couple slides on firm size and shape, but I'm just going to skip to the very end so we can have some more Q&A time. What I want you to take out of this discussion tonight and from the readings is that, you know, Austrian economics does offer a production theory. It's a unique and valuable theory of production. It's not just a verbal rendition of neoclassical production theory, which is what some critics seem to think. You know, in the spirit of what we've been discussing all course long. It's causal and realistic, right? It's talking about entrepreneurs making purposeful decisions about cause and effect, about value, and so on. It's trying to explain the prices of real factors that are produced and used in real factor markets, not imaginary ones, right? It focuses on the economic aspects of production, not just the technological aspects. And it places the entrepreneur at center stage. There's a lot more research that needs to be done in this area, and there are a lot more questions, issues, puzzles that, you know, still need to be worked out or that can be explained with more detailed applications of the kinds of theories that we've discussed, ideas that we've discussed tonight. Okay, let me stop now for some questions. I'm going to scan up a little bit through the chat thread and also look at the Q&A thread. By the way, there's one question that came in early on about supply. I think this is just about the term supply and demand versus demand and supply. No, I'm not using those in asking, am I using those in a particular order? And the answer is no. I mean, I guess you usually hear economists say supply and demand, but they might sometimes say demand and supply. But there's no reason to use one phrasing over the other. Okay, let me see what questions are going on in the chat here. Yes, I know I'm no Bob Murphy on the comedy scene, and certainly not in my singing ability. Okay, so this comment from Peter Cresswell about this whole business about costs and factor prices. Peter, I'm not sure exactly what you mean. Peter says Riesman and von Bawerk are right. Cost of production of the steering wheel is more relevant than MRP, with cost determining factor markets by marginal pairs. Well, okay, but Peter, the way you stated it, I agree in the following sense, right, that what determines the prices of the factors is the MRP on the one side, which determines the demand for the factor, and the physical availability of the factor, and the willingness of the factor owner to make it available on the supply side of the market. Right? But that's not what Riesman, first you say that's more important than MRP. Well, MRP determines the demand side, right? But of course, we also have to look at the supply side, how much of the factor there is, and how much the factor user is willing to make it available. But see, that's where I think the Riesman argument is either wrong or it's trivially right in the following sense that, yeah, if you want to say, well, in the case of the steering wheel, right, the maximum willingness to pay might be the price of the whole value of the whole car, but you don't have to pay that because the costs are really low, right? Fine. But what does that mean to say the costs are really low? cost of producing steering wheels are really low. It means that the MRP or DMRP of the materials used to make the steering wheel is low because there are not that many, you know, they're not highly in demand elsewhere in the economy. Right? I mean, if the steering wheel is made of, you know, steel and plastic and, you know, wood or whatever, if those materials are not urgently needed elsewhere in the economy, then I, as a steering wheel maker, can purchase those inputs at a relatively low price, and I can make steering wheels, and I'm willing to sell them at a pretty low price. Right? So remember my diagram. Actually, let me go back just a second. Slide. Oh, this one. Slide 14. Right? So, I mean, in the example here, we're talking about wages, but imagine that this is steering wheels. Okay, so imagine this is steering wheels. The question is, what determines whether the holders of steering wheels will be willing to make those steering wheels available to users, right? You know, why are they willing to let the steering wheels go, for only whatever, you know, $16 or $17 is in the original reservation demand, as opposed to, you know, letting them go for a much higher reservation demand? What determines the position of this line versus this line? Well, you know, again, if the holder of the steering wheel is, these are just consumers who have steering wheels, you know, and they hold on to them for nostalgic reasons. Maybe this is, you know, these are the steering wheels for some classic car from the 1920s or something. Well, then their willingness to give one up might be based purely on subjective utility. But if they're just commercial steering wheel makers, right, then, you know, what's the lowest price at which they are willing to give up that steering wheel? Well, that depends how much it costs them to get the inputs for the steering wheel, but that is determined by the willingness of other entrepreneurs to pay for the steel and the plastic and the wood or whatever, which is determined by DMRP, which is determined by consumers' valuations for the other things that are made out of those, you know, out of plastic and steel and wood. So it all comes down to DMRP. Right? I mean, it's true. The proximate cause of pricing is given by marginal payers. Right? But what underlies the supply side of the market in the marginal payers analysis for factors is consumer demand for other things that could be, that those factors could be used for. Okay? I hope that makes sense. Let's see. Da-da-da-da-da. Let's see. Yep. Looks like we've covered most of this. Let's see. There's some technical issues on football, all of which is true. Not to go too much into the details of American football for those of you who are not fans. This discussion, these comments from Malcolm, for example, do help to illustrate that in the case of a football quarterback. It's not all increase in the revenues that football teams can make from selling their tickets and so forth. I mean, there may also be a productivity element to it. As Arnold is pointing out, you know, if there is a trend, as there has been in football, to place more emphasis on passing, right, where the quality of the quarterback has a higher marginal impact on whether you win or lose, that's like saying the marginal physical product of Drew Brees is higher than the marginal physical product of some quarterback in an earlier version of the game, you know, in the old days. Maybe it was more based on running in the past, and it didn't really matter what the quarterback did so much. If it's based on passing, then the marginal value of the quarterback for wins and losses, the physical output, is higher than it was before. So in the case of Drew Brees, it could be a combination of things, right? His marginal physical product has gone up, and the price of the stuff that his labor produces has gone up. Then those factors both push in the same direction, drive his salary up, right? I mean, you know, it could be that suppose that fans lose interest in football. They have a lower willingness to pay for football tickets and football merchandise. So let's say the revenues generated from football go down, but at the same time, there's some change in the technology of the game. Let's say it goes back to a running game, right? So running backs have a higher marginal impact on wins and losses than they did before. Right? I mean, you might actually see the salaries of running backs, the best running backs, go up, even though consumer demand for football is going down. Right? So the decreased demand for football tickets and merchandise and so on is reducing the price of the output, which is driving wages down. But if for some workers the marginal physical product is going up, that may outweigh the other effect. So you could have a net increase in the wages of running backs, while the wages of other players in other positions might be going down. Okay, so it's a good way of illustrating the different kind of different factors that impact prices and factors. Okay, let me scan down a little bit more. Okay, Malcolm's asking a question on slide 7. Let me go back and look at it. Okay, let me read your question. Okay, so Malcolm's asking about the equilibrium price versus the price in the market. I don't mean to state that those are different things, right? So, okay, so what Malcolm is asking, even is it 5, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, no, I mean, all we mean by equilibrium price in this context is the price, you know, again, think of these as plain state of rest prices. These are the prices that are actually paid in the market for the factor, right? So, now I see what you're asking. Malcolm's saying, I was a little bit unclear in the way I described this example, right? So in this example, the reservation demands are below the demand curve, right? So the most that buyers would be willing to pay, entrepreneurs in this case, for the fifth unit of the factor is $20, right? But here's a guy who has a unit of the factor and would be willing to let it go for as little as $17, okay? So if there's only one demander, there's only one entrepreneur, and there's one seller of this fifth unit, then they can simply bargain, right? I mean, it might be the case that the entrepreneur, if he's shrewd, right, is able to get the price down below 20, right? Now, he can't get it for less than 17 because 05 will not give it up for anything less than 17. And it can't be more than 20, right, because this buyer will not be willing to pay more than 20 for the fifth unit. When I was going through this example before, maybe I didn't state this clearly, I was assuming that you have multiple entrepreneurs bidding against each other for the services of that factor, right? So in other words, if, you know, first off, and this is, you know, this is Von Bauer's marginal pairs, right? So there's, you know, it's like there's lots of buyers, and the buyers and sellers can communicate with each other, and they can negotiate as a group, right? So if an entrepreneur says, you know, there's only one person who has this fifth unit, and one entrepreneur says, hey, you know, I know that you're, offers, $18, and this guy says, oh, well, you know, yeah, I'd be willing to let it go for as little as 17, so sure, I'll take your 18. But then another entrepreneur says, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to let Klein get it for 18 because it has an MRP, a DMRP of 20. In other words, it generates $20 worth of revenue. So the other entrepreneur says, well, no, I'll pay you 18 for it. Another one says, no, I'll pay you 19. Another one says, I'll pay you 19.50. I'll pay you 19.99. Right? So if there is competition among entrepreneurs for the services of that factor, and there is at least one holder of the factor willing to sell it at a price below that DMRP, then, you know, the equilibrium price, the plain state of rest price in this market is going to be $20, right? That's because I'm assuming there are at least two entrepreneurs competing against each other for this factor. But you're right. If there's only one entrepreneur, then he might be able to get a price lower than 20, right? He might be able to get a price between 20 and 17. So, in other words, you know, when I said on even slides before this, right, that, you know, in the evenly rotating economy, the prices of factors of production will tend to equal their discounted marginal revenue products. You can interpret that statement precisely in two ways, right? Either what you mean is the maximum willingness to pay of any entrepreneur will be the DMRP, $20 or whatever, or you can say if there is competition among entrepreneurs, then the price will be bid up to the DMRP. Right? And of course, any entrepreneur would be delighted to get the factor at a price below its DMRP. But if they're competing against each other, that isn't going to be possible. Okay? So that's why when I say the equilibrium price is 20, I mean the equilibrium price, plain stated rest price, actual price, in a market where you have, what did we call it last time? You know, multiple, we have competition on both margins, multiple buyers, multiple sellers. Okay? All right, well, I hope that, Malcolm, I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, please email me or post in the comment thread on Moodle. But it's 8 o'clock Eastern, so our time is up. We will meet again this time next week, talk a little bit more about entrepreneurship, and we'll talk about market structure, competition, monopoly, and so on. I'm looking forward to that discussion, so I will see you then. Good night, everybody.